Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Andrew Baglio with us. Andrew has since 2001 been a principal, trumpet player for the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. Before that, he played for several years with the Israel Philharmonic. He is also the founder of the Future Symphony Institute, about which we shall hear in the next half hour. His biography, which you can see at andrewbaglio.com, also lists intensive religious training, another topic for us to pursue. Welcome, Andrew.
Oh, very nice to be here, Mark.
Well, let's just jump right in, and we'll give you the big broad question. Where does classical music stand in America today?
Well, it's very interesting. Overall, across the nation, it's at an all-time high in terms of numbers of orchestras playing a record number of concerts. You know, the technical capability of these orchestras is at an incredible zenith. And the number of people who've attended classical concerts at least once is quite high. But what's interesting is that towns that used to be too small to support an orchestra actually grew into formidable cities that can now sustain an entire symphony orchestra for much of the year, at least enough to give justification to having an orchestra running there. So now what we're seeing is, the high culture is coming to these places that were, should we say, more off the beaten track, weren't part of these, the big cities where all the culture kind of got nested, where all the big fancy museums and whatnot. So now you can go to these cities that are, you know, really very livable and smaller, and there's a top symphony orchestra there. So in that sense, it's kind of like Major League Baseball. You have a lot of expansion of teams and or NFL places. So that's that's on the upside. But there are also there have just like in business, there have been some failures. In my city where I live right now, Baltimore, we had an opera company, a really storied opera company for 75 years, and in its 75th year, it went bankrupt. And that was a real tragedy for our city, because we have a beautiful opera house, historic opera house called the Lyric Theater, and plenty of opera lovers, but for a number of reasons, it couldn't sustain. And those are the stories that we remember the most, the failures. And I think it's really wrong to draw a conclusion that classical music itself is failing. When we see an institution close its doors, it's because there was usually a failure of management. So that it's a failure to thrive, but it doesn't speak necessarily of the overall potential for the art form.
That's good news, because the business analogy, that instantly made sense to me. Of course, in any thriving industry, you're going to get some businesses that fail.
Yeah.
Sometimes. And maybe somehow in the cultural sphere, those not so frequent failures, they just have a more powerful symbolic meaning, perhaps because they are indicating a broader failure about those localities that... You know, the symbolic meaning of the symphony is it represents the city in some way, in the condition of the city.
Well, yeah, that was the idea, that these founding fathers of these cities, they were institution builders. They wanted their city to have great monuments to culture. They built, they had these really great hospitals, and they have established these tremendous museums. In a permanent way, these museums architecturally are very imposing, and then have a symphony hall and the libraries. And it was that they were taking the old world and transplanting it into the new. That was the model, and that's how culture is replicated and transmitted.
Right, right. Did you hear yesterday Mark Zuckerberg announced that he's giving $200 million to support the installation of a youth opera in San Jose? I'm just kidding.
Right.
I know. I'm waiting for those technology titans to do the same thing for cultural institutions that the robber barons did, 120 years ago for the great institutions.
The love of classical music has not changed, but philanthropy has changed seismically. I can't overstate how much philanthropy has changed. So we're no longer simply trying to grow these intrinsic goods in our communities, our church, the symphony, the local hospital, taking care of the poor, things like that. We're responsible for Africa. We're responsible for the entire world. And there's all these philanthropies that deal in very, very broad things that they may or may not be actually impacting. But they because Silicon Valley, our captains of industry are very entranced by the next huge idea, and they get lured into those things.
And you know, they're not grounded in where they live. They've all moved there. They don't have family histories there. They don't. Mm-hmm. They don't have roots in the land, and they don't have an investment in creating, you know, civic and cultural life in this place.
Yes, they're part of this international. Yeah. Cosmopolitan elite that they have homes all around the world. Bill Gates recently admonished all the major philanthropists of our country that they should stop giving to cultural institutions like museums.
Did he?
And he admonished them sternly and told them they should be giving all their money to Africa, for example. And I don't mean to pick on Africa, but
but he's a Philistine. Bill Gates is a Philistine.
Oh, absolutely.
He has no cultural refinement. He's not a very well-read individual. In fact, there is no humanistic sense of things in his outlook.
But some of them actually do have this side.
Peter Thiel certainly
is a really good example.
He's a great exception.
And with the work of our institute, what things that we follow these.
Let's get to that. What is the institute that you have created? Maybe first of all, tell us the website for the institute.
Oh, it's called futuresymphony.org.
Futuresymphony.org.
Yes, it's the website for the Future Symphony Institute, and we're quite new. We only launched in 2014 with Sir Roger Scruton as one of our research fellows, and we have these other incredibly esteemed thinkers who've joined our ranks. And we are not yet what we want to be. We would like to grow it to be a fully functioning research institute to study the sustainability of classical music.
And that's the key, the sustainability.
Yes, it's a sustainability model. It's not a profitability model. It's simply sustainability. And it's a subject that deserves to be studied, just in the same way that churches have been studied, and their in their ebbs and flows.
I just see the number of young people, some of them very smart, my students at the university, mm-hmm. who simply have lacked any exposure to classical music.
Yeah.
It's just not on their radar at all. This is not a joke. I mentioned classical music and a student came to my office and she said, "You and my dad would get along. He loves that stuff like Steve Miller Band." And I said, "What?" She thought I meant classic rock.
Right.
And I said, no, I mean Mozart.
Yeah.
I mean, she goes, okay. But I mean, they know some of those names.
Yeah.
But the idea that any young person living in the United States should go through the schools and pass through our culture and not have some immersion in the classical music, what a loss, right? What a missing experience that is from their lives.
Yeah, well, classical music, it's not just classical music, it's classical culture, it's all the great ideas, the great great art, all these great things that we used to transmit to children as a matter of course of being raised. That is what has changed.
Right.
Doesn't mean that we can't build, that we can't figure out a good, decent future, you know, because of that. But that's a casualty of the culture wars. But what's happened in America, and of course your incredible book that you wrote that chronicles all of this vanquishing of our cultural inheritance. What's happened is that we have all these pockets of culture, of high culture, you know, pockets of families that are transmitting these things to children. So you have the haves and the have-nots. A lot of these children have been denied all the good stuff, yeah, all the real goodies, the great ideas, the best books. I mean, nowadays, you know, to give an example, it's just utility that children learn to read so that they can know how to read. It used to be we learned to read really fast because we had all these books we had to read for all the moral lessons and the complexities and relations, all these things that were embedded in novels.
Right.
And that's what, what's interesting to know, and we were talking about the Silicon Valley titans of industry. This is what's interesting to us. Those people have children, and they keep their children off the internet.
That's right. That's right. They are low-tech households.
Yes, and they have their kids are taking violin lessons and piano lessons because at some level, these guys know that it's the three-dimensional world. It's the it's the learning from actual real books. It's not watching movies that you can't. That it's this slow learning, this slow culture of the slow grind. That's what develops minds, and what's going to happen is because that filters down. Once people see the middle class, when they see what the super rich people are doing with their kids, they follow suit. And high culture is always like that. It always filters down from the highest classes down through the middle class, and even the poorest classes are mimicking things that were done, that we couldn't, that only the richest could do 100 years ago.
Right.
So this is, and another thing to that point, yes, piano lessons are missing from children's lives. There are no more, very few bands in public schools. But if we look at iTunes, classical downloads are
taking off.
Well, they're showing that people are very much listening to classical music. You have all these free downloads. They're listening down. You can just, it's just space on your iPod or your computer. Mm-hmm. That much we see. So the interest in classical music has not diminished. It's just the way it's consumed, shall we say, has changed.
Well, I will say that when people get the exposure, they recognize that there's something great going on here. My son plays cello. Mm. He's in a Suzuki program. They do these camps, and at one camp they did in California, Northern California, they went into the local town and just set up, a small little orchestra, all the strings. They set up in a plaza, in a public plaza, like on an open air mall, and they just started playing some of those Suzuki songs, the minuets by different, or allegros, and people stopped. They were enchanted to see these 12, 13-year-olds all playing this lovely classical music. And it was a different air than you would have gotten if they were playing another kind of music. It would have been different. But there was something a little magical in the way them started playing, created this little space of a musical experience for everyone around there. And I will, in my literature classes, I'll sometimes, if I'm doing The Wasteland, Eliot, T.S. Eliot has some quotations from Wagner, actually some from Tristan, some from Rheingold, and I'll actually play some of it for them. And it's quite different from what they're accustomed to. But I think all of them recognize this is another level of music going on here. And it's going to take time. They know I have to listen to this for a while before I really start to hear it. But I'm always hoping, you guys, do something different. Don't just go along with the mass culture, the youth culture. Don't do what everyone else does. Be different. Isn't that what everyone always tells you? Be different. Okay, classical music, that's different. So
yes, and it does trade on that. It trades on higher attainment. Classical music is part of this. It's difficult, it's hard. And there's a certain kind of person that wants to be part of that world of hard-won, should we say, valor,
greatness.
They want to work
momentousness.
For goodness sake, you know, people are working extremely hard to do all sorts of things that they don't have to do, you know, just their physical fitness or any number of things, because people love a challenge, particularly smart people. The smart people just love to have some type of puzzle to feast upon, and it could be something aesthetic, such as, you know, art, or, you know, learning about art. And that, right. what's happening, I think there's a great backlash right now, particularly among young people. They know they've been ripped off. They resent the trophies they were given just for showing up. They look at those trophies that, you know, if they still have them, and they know that they...
Self-esteem shouldn't be so easily won.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. So there's something in this whole... the thing that's happened with classical music is the same thing that's happened to the universities, where the substance, or at least the humanities, rather. I shouldn't talk about the sciences, of course. I know the sciences...
Maybe the softer sciences it applies.
Yeah, the social sciences and the humanities have been eviscerated of their real value, because the substance of what they're doing isn't... they threw out all the babies with the bathwater.
Well, the National Humanities Alliance put out a toolkit the other day, and endorsed by the Modern Language Association on this, for how to defend the humanities. And it's what you said a few minutes ago. Everything is instrumentalized. Yeah. They will give you... The humanities will give you career skills. They will give you critical thinking. Nothing about Shakespeare, nothing about Beethoven, yeah. Nothing about the substance.
Yeah.
You know, you said we teach reading so that they'll be good readers. No, they teach reading so they can read Macbeth.
Yeah, that's the point.
It's the thing. It's the stuff. It's the objects, and that's what's going to bring kids back to the humanities
we have the same problem in classical music. What we're up against, even though it sounds like they're defending us, what they're trying to say is that classical music has all sorts of cognitive benefits. It's a neurological...
The Mozart effect.
Yeah, or something like that.
If our listeners know what that is.
Yeah, if they try to create some correlation that you're somehow... It's like taking your child's brain, taking it to the gym, it's lifting weights by having to learn an instrument and balance all these issues at once.
Right.
Indeed, the brain, you know, they discovered that the brain, yes, is very active during music performance and whatnot. But that's, you know, so then we have to ask, take the pill test. If neuroscience came up with a pill that could duplicate all of those right. cognitive benefits that suddenly your brain was...
Why bother with classical music?
Would we still bother with classical music?
Yes.
And the answer is yes.
Of course.
Because it's really an issue of human flourishing. Because we know that we're most alive when our kids are with their little Suzuki orchestra playing in the town square for everybody. How proud were you as a father when that happened?
He's proud of himself. They feel the accomplishment. He loves playing with with others his age. The teamwork factor is one of the great things about the camps that they do. All the kids play. They play together, and they actually become very, very close. But it's discipline. It is rigorous. If anyone gets anything wrong, everyone knows, and it ruins everything.
Yeah.
So when I worked for the National Endowment for the Arts, I came into thinking, well, you know, the arts, they're kind of soft and fuzzy, and everyone's a genius. And then I went to visit some schools and sat in on things like the band orchestra practices at some of the bigger schools that had that kind of thing, and I thought, wow. This is doggone rigorous here, and they are working, and they're out to get it right, and there's no soft and fuzzy stuff here.
Well, I will come to your defense. Modernist art and modernist music is soft and fuzzy.
Okay.
It takes no skill to throw a bunch of paint on a canvas, just splattered all over the place. It takes nothing to just you know, bang on some drums or to just to do, you know, follow your, you know, just that sort of undisciplined, unstructured musical study, but to paint even a vase and some flowers in a convincing way is extremely challenging. Painting a human face. That is the hardest thing to do. And to the people who've done that, first of all, the thousands of children who tried to paint human faces, when they go into a museum, they appreciate the portraits. They go, oh my goodness, that is really amazing how that they were able to do that. So they gain that appreciation. Likewise, there's a real classical music is very complex, but it's highly ordered. And that your son is studying classical music is learning about all these different layers of beauty going on concurrently, and that it comes from an order. It's not just doing what he feels. He's not being told to emote, to express himself. He's being told, he's learning craftsmanship, to render somebody else's composition and do it expertly with great attention with other people at the same time. That project that's the real stuff. And many young people want to be part of that. They want to be part of the greatness. They know that they were told they could just splatter paint all over a painting, over a canvas, and they were shortchanged. They know that they didn't learn anything.
Is the closest equivalent high school sports with discipline and competition? There's a winner. Not everyone's a winner. Everyone can compete.
Well, they tried taking out the winners. They tried to just, to not keep score, and they noticed the motivation fell off a cliff.
Yeah.
And it got into all sorts of issues of this terrible thing kept happening. This thing called human nature kept showing up.
You know, look at the National Spelling Bee. That is intense. The pressure, the competition, and the winning and losing. And everyone in the audience
loves
it.
Because there's a right spelling.
You got to get it right.
Plenty of parents who want to say, plenty of factions, you know, they want to say there's no correct way to spell.
Right. Well, when I was at the Arts Endowment again, the chairman, Dan Joya, worked up a competition called Poetry Out Loud, in which it was a competition on the model of the National Spelling Bee. It was around the country. High schools did it. And students would get up and recite poems. They would perform the poems, and they were evaluated by a professional poets, reciters, dramaturges, and it was that you got money, you could get scholarship, it would go to state levels and then national levels, and I went to some of the competitions, and these 15-year-olds in the audience, they were fired up. It was being like at the Super Bowl for them, because it was about a performance. Everything had to be right. And by the way, the Arts Endowment stuck to our guns. Dana Joya stuck to her guns by saying, we are going to issue you a list of poems. Yeah. Because some of the state arts council people said, let them write their own poems and recite them. No, it's going to be Ezra Pound. It's going to be John Donne. It's going to be the great poems, and you're going to select. We had a long list. You can select one. But let me ask you, does this get into issues of politics having entered into classical music, the performances, the institutions? Has politicization happened in the way it has happened, say, in museums, in the library world? The library has just removed Laura Ingalls Wilder's name, Little House on the Prairie, from one of its annual awards because she represented people of color in
long overdue.
Insufficiently.
I was wondering if they catch up with her eventually. I didn't know how she got to pass all these years.
Is this kind of thing going on in the music,
Mark,
classical music world?
It's incredible. When I started this study of the sustainability of symphony orchestras and the and classical music itself, I thought that if we brought together the best business minds to just run these institutions far better, then we'd be okay. But the deeper I got into this subject, all roads kept leading back to politics. Because I was really struck when I came back to the United States after spending most of my professional career outside of the U.S. I came back in my 30s to join this really fine American orchestra, and I kept being hit in the face with all this strange jargon and all these strange decisions, things that made no sense at all, that seemed counter to...
How about an example?
Well, an example is just harping on trying to get all these people who didn't want to come to the symphony, trying to get them to come to the symphony, rather than focusing on the people who we knew very well were only inches away from pulling the trigger and buying a ticket, namely the friend. Like, here's a good example. In the early 2000s, when I came to the U.S. from Israel, the first baby boomers were turning 65, meaning that they were retiring. This enormous wave of people who retired with a great deal of saved wealth and all this extra time on their hands. So I thought, that is going to be what defines orchestras, is a competition for baby boomers' times.
Sure.
No.
Makes sense.
Not at all. That was precise. At that moment, then we went on a crusade
to get more
young people and to get more diversity in not only in the audiences, but in within the orchestras. Suddenly, which everything became driven by identity politics. So as we were saying, so much of my work has been having to study the effects of critical theory on taking down classical music. Classical music is just another trophy for these, what we call it, progressivism. They want to take
down.
It's
elite, Eurocentric, Christian.
It has all those things, yes. It's all this Christianity embedded. It's what they call problematic. So we've been tagged with problems. So we're yet another trophy in this march through the institutions. They got through the humanities, and the public schools are now are completely owned by that.
It seems obvious. If that's your approach, then you need money. Go get the baby boomers, who are much easier to bring in, and then. Then you can do your outreach
here
and here and
here. Disparage them. They insult them. They disparage them. They talk about old people like they were, vagrants squatting on your front steps. They were so disparaging of the elderly in the classical music business. And then there's this.
Because they had what, conservative tastes? Is that
no? It's just because
they're just old.
They're not cool.
They're not cool.
They're not cool enough for us. And that somehow there's all this wisdom when you're young. And so the question that keeps being raised in the classical music community is, why aren't we need to listen to millennials? We need to ask them what they, try to mine them for all this wisdom that they have.
They don't
like it when us old people are asking them all these questions, because they think we're lame, that we have to ask millennials what to do next.
So we
shoot ourselves in the foot twice.
I think this is one distinction between conservatives and progressives. Progressives think you're wiser when you're young. Conservatives think you're wiser when you're old. I think that actually holds here, but. Look, is this a workable strategy from what you've seen?
No.
Has history proven them right or wrong?
Well, it makes no sense whatsoever. And that's why when you see an orchestra threatening to close its doors, it's usually because of this type of mismanagement that they're chasing.
Mismanagement, which has at least as one cause, ideological.
Yes, it is ideologically driven. That is what I discovered, and I found myself studying the workings of progressive politics versus small-c conservative politics. The type of the Russell Kirks, Roger Scruton, these types of localists, the agrarians, these type of these type of conservatives, not partisan politics, Republicans.
No.
I just want to be clear about
tradition,
that.
Maintaining tradition, maintaining cultures, customs.
Yeah, these traditions are a type of knowledge. It's a wisdom. It's understanding human nature and what worked in the past, and then it's probably going to work in the future in many ways.
So politicization affected programming.
Well, yes, it did. So what happened was there was a composer named Arnold Schoenberg, who.
I would walk by Schoenberg Hall at UCLA.
Oh, right. There you go. Right, of course. And he found the perfect place to live in California, where he was a brilliant composer, wrote beautiful, heartbreakingly beautiful music, but then he stopped. And then he decided he had
theorizing.
To, yeah, he because he was a tremendous mathematician, a true genius. And he thought that he could arrive at a better music through this mathematical reasoning, and created his 12-tone system and started writing. He became a guru to all of this generation of progressive, of modernist composers who wanted to supplant the old music. So then there was this whole canon of modernist music that was unbearably ugly. It was the only time that it was ever really used effectively was in horror movies, when something terribly discordant, the whole world was coming apart, when the aliens blew up the earth, then they used atonal music. That's the only way you can describe these terrible things. Or, you know, someone, a zombie, for example. You need atonal chords for zombies.
Okay.
So this is, of course, what happened was, once again, they smashed up against human nature. People couldn't stand listening to this stuff, so they kept getting up and leaving. It was our audiences that saved classical music from these ideologues. Whereas the modernist painters, these paintings that don't really bear that much consideration, other than being a social phenomenon. Now, there's an enormous amount that can be said about what's going on down at the MoMA, for example. That is it's a financial, sociological phenomenon. And there's plenty to say, and it's really happening because it's moving. They're moving billions of dollars with that stuff. But in terms of, but those are not works of art that you're going to consider for very long. Right. Whereas, yeah.
Well, is the... You intimated the religious element in classical music is very strong.
Well,
is that one of the problems right there?
That's a big problem, because almost the entirety of all the what we call classical music, and I say almost only because some of these secularists of the 20th century truly divorced themselves from the tradition of what we call classical music. But the vast majority of it, the music that you and I love, that that people fill concert halls, even here in New York, they fill the concert halls to hear music that was written to glorify God. Even music that was written
Mozart, Beethoven,
even
Brahms.
Even in the Soviet Union, where the churches had been vanquished and God had been driven out, even the Prokofiev and the Shostakovich, that so much of that is mourning the loss. Even though you can hear it in Rachmaninoff, mourning the loss of God in their homeland. So even that it's in itself is I would count it as part of the Christian canon. So this is a big problem, because when you have this vast classical music
should be a bigger part of the Christian canon.
Yes, most definitely in Christian upbringing, Christian life. The flip side of this whole thing is that churches also got rid of classical music, music that was expressly written for religious occasions, or at least was informed by a Christian worldview. And I should, not every piece of music obviously is a sacred work. There's plenty of But at least it was a Christian worldview that informed its notion of what was beautiful and how we understand joy, what we even understand what is a virtue within music. So I'm speaking very broadly here. But the churches, they need classical music, because they've tried to come up with a modern music, maybe a more the Christian rock or all these things. They're trying to find a music that takes people to a deeper devotion, but it doesn't work, because the nature, the very nature of the musical fabric they're using is not non-material. It's very terrestrial. And what goes on in church needs to be about the other side, about taking that. So if you listen to early music polyphony, these beautiful chants where they, they're timeless. It's this meditation on the harmony of the spheres. That's why those old masses work so beautifully. If you know, like Josquin des Prez, or De Victoria, or Machaut, or Palestrina especially. I mean, that music puts you into the right state of mind for communion with God.
Andrew, we're out of time. Oh. I absolutely insist you have to come back and do another podcast where we can extend on precisely that issue. And I'd actually like to get into your religious formation. You have an interesting history there with your religious studies and how that leads into your musical career. So thank you for coming, sir.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you so much, Mike.